1,000 potential Earths in deep space. As we were writing this book, a new candidate, Kepler-452b, was added to the list. Situated 1,400 light-years away, making it one of the closest possibilities, the size of Kepler-452b and its distance from the star it orbits fall into the Goldilocks zone, of perhaps being not too hot or too cold to sustain oceans and be suitable for life. In total, the universe contains as many stars as 1 followed by 23 zeros, or 100 sextillion. A staggering number, but by no means the most staggering. A vast amount of luminous matter, in the form of stars, lights up the galaxies. Even though there are more stars than grains of sand on Earth, they only make up 10% of the total mass in the observable universe. Calculating the total number of protons and electrons making up regular atomic matter, one comes up with 1 followed by 80 zeros, or 100,000 trillion sextillion 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 atoms. This is equivalent to 25 million sextillion Earths. Here the visible trail dwindles away, because all this luminous matter accounts for approximately 4% of the stuff in the universe. Most of it, 96% or so, is dark and therefore unseen and unknown. But at least we have a credible inventory of the cosmos, as produced by NASA's Wilkinson Microwave Probe, WMAP, 4.6% regular matter, 24% dark matter, and 71.4% dark energy. Most of the universe is at the very least quite exotic. Quite a black box indeed. As things stand, dark matter and energy are surmises formulated by painstaking, elaborate lines of reasoning. Their actual existence is several steps removed from seeing is believing. Some skeptics warn that physics is flirting with fantasy. Imagine that you are looking around the animal kingdom and see horses galloping through the open plains. Turning your gaze, you also see a one-horned sea mammal called the narwhal. Do these visible facts allow you to reason that unicorns are real, with the body of a horse and the horn of the narwhal? Our modern answer is no. But in the Middle Ages, there wasn't such a strict divide between the real and the mythical. Cosmology is currently saddled with the full menagerie of mythical creatures, from quarks and superstrings to the multiverse, created through mathematical inference alone. Dark matter is a prime example of real by inference. First, dark matter is inferred from the speeded-up rotation of the stars in a typical galaxy. The stars are being pulled around by the gravitational force of some outside mass faster than physics can account for. NASA uses gravity in the same way when it steers a space probe close to a huge planet like Jupiter or Saturn, so that the planet's gravity can serve as a slingshot, speeding up the probe as it whips past. As normally measured, the typical galaxy doesn't contain enough mass to explain the observed rotation, nor does the known universe. Second, most galaxies are found in clusters of various sizes. Some are small, containing only a few galaxies, while others are massive, containing tens of thousands of galaxies and emitting vast amounts of X-rays. These giant clusters also seem to contain more mass than is counted up, either in stars or the gaseous material inside the cluster, which is only observed through X-rays. By inference, more matter must be contained somewhere inside the cluster. Finally, when distant background galaxies are observed as their light passes through a nearer cluster of galaxies, such as the Bullet Cluster, the bending of its light due to the gravitational field inside the near cluster, acting as a gravitational lens, indicates that a lot more dark matter resides inside the cluster. These three pieces of evidence are in agreement, based on the same variable, gravity. They result in precise numerical predictions that have been confirmed. The inferences being drawn aren't weak, but they aren't sufficient either. To illustrate, imagine that you are in a windowless room that's rotating like a star. You can feel the centrifugal force as you are bounced against the walls, and you infer that something is pulling on the room from the outside. That's a strong inference, but you can see its limitations to describe where the external force is coming from. A tornado, an angry elephant, a giant playing with his toys. Nothing can be said realistically with only an inference to go on, despite the finest calculations from inside the room telling you how strong the force is. When darkness rules. Since darkness appears to be the rule in creation, solving the mystery of what the universe is made of must begin there, and almost immediately get stymied. Most cosmologists currently believe that dark matter is cold, meaning that within a year after the Big Bang, its particles were moving slowly in relation to the speed of light. As you've come to expect, these particles are just a matter of conjecture at this point. It's also been proposed that dark matter may come in three types: hot, warm, and cold. For example, subatomic particles known as neutrinos have been nominated to form hot dark matter, bringing it closest to the realm of ordinary matter. Warm dark matter is thought to exist as brown dwarfs, objects that are too small to light up via thermonuclear reactions the way ordinary stars do. On a more solid footing, the consensus today holds that cold dark matter is composed of weakly interacting massive particles, WIMPs, which are heavy and slow-moving. The aptly named WIMPs interact via gravitation and the weak force alone. They would be completely hidden were it not for their distribution over the whole universe and the large proportion of total matter they constitute, exerting a powerful gravitational force. Dark energy is considerably more exotic and seems to be vastly more present, whereas dark matter, although unseen, still influences the visible universe via its gravitational pull. Dark energy acts as anti-gravity, pulling the universe apart at large scales. For example, beyond the scale of galaxies and clusters of galaxies. How this actually takes place, and providing a theoretical explanation, is no small mystery. Even for it to exist requires precise measurements of how fast the galaxies are accelerating away from one another. According to how many stars you take into account, the key ones are very distant supernovas. The value for dark energy shifts considerably. Some skeptics challenge whether the galaxies are accelerating at all, which would undercut dark energy completely. But cold dark matter with dark energy is currently taken to be the standard model of cosmology. We supposedly inhabit a flat universe, dominated by dark energy, with smaller amounts of dark mass and even smaller amounts of luminous, or ordinary matter. From another viewpoint entirely, darkness could be a case of how we observe the universe rather than what it really is. The giant particle accelerators that blast subatomic particles into view operate on the tiniest scale, mere billionths of a meter and billionths of a second. Is that kind of observation compatible with the effect of dark matter, which operates on the largest scale, billions of light years in size? Before anyone can answer yes or no, one has to challenge if what we see today is the same as what existed long ago. Almost certainly, it isn't. The acceleration that is making the galaxies fly apart faster and faster began very late in the game, roughly 6 billion years ago. Before then, cosmologists believe that the expansion was actually decelerating. That's because dark matter and dark energy evolve differently in an expanding universe. When the early universe doubled in volume, dark matter density was halved. But dark energy density remained and remains constant. When the balance tipped in favor of dark energy, deceleration turned to acceleration. The "we haven't even started yet" camp is bolstered by gaps in the standard model. What would it take for totally new thinking to take hold? The journey begins with the psychological aspect of reality, which von Neumann called essential. Seconding him are an array of eminent physicists from the beginning discoveries of the quantum era. Max Planck was adamant that reality at bottom involves consciousness. As he put it, all matter originates and exists only by virtue of a force. We must assume behind this force the existence of a conscious and intelligent mind. This mind is the matrix of all matter. This means that lumps of matter are no longer floating out there, like snowflakes that fall from the sky and collect on your coat collar, but rather matter is embraced in the same matrix that holds thoughts and dreams. Planck's belief that mind is even more basic than matter is expressed with total clarity here. I regard consciousness as fundamental. I regard matter as a derivative from consciousness. Everything that we talk about, everything that we regard as existing, postulates consciousness. If you're looking for totally new thinking, it's been around a while. What was lacking was acceptance. So let's build some. Reality is a mind game. Pioneers are bold almost by definition. But what made Planck join Schrödinger in his staunch belief that the universe is mind-like? It goes back to a fact almost too basic to need stating. Namely, that everything we experience is an experience. Does this actually tell us anything? Burning your tongue on hot coffee is obviously an experience, and so is building the New Horizons space probe, launching it with a huge missile so that it travels at 36,000 miles per hour through space, boosted to 47,000 miles per hour as it receives a boost swinging around Jupiter, waiting 9 years for it to journey almost 6 billion miles to Pluto, and then sending up a cheer, as astronomers did on July 14, 2015, when New Horizons sent back the first close-up photos of the last major body in the solar system. Burning your tongue and photographing Pluto stand on equal footing as experiences, and doing any kind of science is also an experience. So Planck was asserting that this fact counts, all the time and very deeply. If you can level things as different as the smell of a rose, the blast of a volcanic explosion, a Shakespeare sonnet, and a space probe, then the matrix of reality is no longer physical. This offers a tremendous advantage when you reach the dead end that physical stuff has reached. The simplicity of turning to a totally new paradigm is that darkness no longer has to be considered alien. The matrix has no trouble including it, because all the stuff in the universe has become mind stuff. Here, the physicalists shove their oar in. Making solid objects vanish is child's play, compared with bringing them back again. How does mind stuff, which has no mass or energy, manage to create mass and energy? The matrix that Planck calls consciousness is nothing more, the physicalists might claim, than the universe with all its mysteries unsolved. Sticking on the tag consciousness doesn't really produce any answers. This skeptical attitude has been paraphrased as, "What is matter? Never mind. What is mind? Doesn't matter." In the spirit of fairness, the two camps face equal but opposite difficulties. One must show how the material universe developed the phenomenon of mind, while the other must show how the cosmic mind manufactured matter. At first blush, we're back in the big muddy of theology, which failed to answer how God did either one. The observer problem pokes its head up. John von Neumann, having included a psychological component in his version of quantum mechanics, seems to have a foot in both camps. But it's a shaky place to stand. Let's say that he was right, and reality cannot be separated from personal experience. This doesn't explain how an experience dips into the quantum level. There's no doubt that subjectivity is a powerful force for altering reality. As humorist Garrison Keillor says on his popular radio show, Prairie Home Companion, "Well, that's the news from Lake Wobegon, where all the women are strong, all the men are good-looking, and all the children are above average." That's subjectivity overriding reality. But it's another thing to hold that subjectivity creates reality. The problem becomes easier if we stop seeing subjectivity as the opposite of objectivity. They are actually merged into each other. The reason we know this is because the subjective side of experience can't be isolated or subtracted. In other words, when everything is an experience, and everything is, subjectivity must always be present. Naturally, the physicalist camp resists this claim quite strongly. For a century, this great bone of contention has been known as the observer problem. Before it can measure something, science must first observe it. In the classical world, there was no problem observing whatever lay before us. Tadpoles, the rings of Saturn, or light being refracted through a prism. One experimenter could leave the room, and no matter who took his place, the observation would remain the same. The observer is only a problem if the very act of looking creates a change in the thing you are looking at. In the human world, we encounter this all the time. If someone gazes at you with love in their eyes, you are very likely to change, and you will change again if the look becomes indifferent or hostile instead. This change can extend very deep to physical reactions in your body. If you blush or your heart beats faster, the chemistry of your physiology is reacting to a mere look. What makes the observer problem unique in quantum physics is that the act of observation can be enough to bring particles into existence in time and space. This is technically known as the collapse of the wave function, meaning that a probability wave, which is invisible and extends